Rosa.
It's time for the Turfgrass Zealot Audiocast. From the Worldwide Command Center of Intergalactic Turfheads, it's the Turfgrass Zealot Audiocast. Only on Turfnet Radio. With a chief turfhead, the guru of fescue, the Alatollah of iron, Mr. Dave Wilbur. There's only one zealot, only on Turfnet Radio.
Hey Turfheads, it's Dave Wilbur and welcome to the Turfgrass Zealot Project. I am doing great today, and so I think I'll just spread a little bit of the love, and hopefully you're doing great too. So I have this thing that I want to work on a little bit on the Turfgrass Zealot Project, because you know, it's a project, and all projects need work. Some of you may be having a hard time either relating to or being related to, as it has to do with this thing called generational science. What, Dave? Generational science, really? This is a word? Well, it is. It really is. And what it comes down to is that whether you like it or not, there are distinct cultural differences between age groups. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I've been looking at some discussions on the TurfNet forums and just with some of my friends as we talk about their kids, as we talk about ourselves getting older. I don't want to say that I'm getting older. I don't believe that I'm getting older. I still surround myself with youthful things and youthful pursuits, and sometimes that can drive some of the people around me a little bit crazy, but I'm okay, man. I mean, I wear my Batman t-shirt. I'm influenced by things from my youth, you know, from when I was a kid. I watched every episode of Star Trek, and I can tell you Star Trek trivia that most people, well, let's just say that it goes a little too far sometimes. How about that? I'm excited about the Star Wars movie that's coming out because I remember being a kid and just being super stoked to, like, you know, lightsabers and all that sort of stuff. I mean, that's me. And I've always been a little bit ahead on the curve when it comes to early adopting. I was on the internet pretty early, before a lot of people even knew what that was. And I don't know. I was pretty young when I got my first big breaks in the golf business. Those kinds of things, right? So what I'm going to do on the Turfgrass Zealot Project today is I've brought a couple of guests in. One of them you probably know, Chris Tritabaugh from Hazeltine National. Chris recently wrote some really cool stuff on the TurfNet forums about kind of how he feels about his work-life balance kind of things, both for himself personally and how he runs his staff. And I asked Chris to get with me and expand on that a little bit, and he was more than happy to do it. So I've got Chris Tritabaugh coming up as a guest. I also have a second guest that maybe you've heard of him if you've watched my Twitter or my Facebook feed, because I've been a big supporter, a big fan of his, and talked about him a lot. Talked about his TED Talk and all that sort of stuff. But my good friend Scott Hess is here, and he is going to talk to us a little bit about generational science. It's the thing that he's into. And let me tell you about Scott Hess. I mean, you know, big corporations hire him to come and do training and come do speeches and all that sort of stuff. I mean, he is a somebody in his world. And I'm not just talking about a minor somebody. We're talking about a major somebody. And he was so kind and willing to sit down with me and have some interview time. And we're super lucky about that. So that's it, man. That's what's going on the Turfgrass Zealot Project today. And before we get to that, I want to take a look at some emails that I've been getting. Just really quick. A couple of things that have been... I love emails. I love comments. You know, like I just can't get enough of that. I got a really great email from Paul McCormick, who writes the Mindful Superintendent for TurfNet, and he just was very supportive about me and the Turfgrass Zealot project, and I think that was really cool. And I appreciate it, Paul. And guess what? We're gonna, because of that, you're gonna pay for your sins by being a guest on an upcoming episode of The Zealot. Let's see. Here's another email that I got. Dear Dave, I'm thinking they don't all say Dear Dave. I just do that. Dear Dave, I'm thinking that maybe you spend too much time talking about yourself. Ooh. Well, look, I mean, it's my podcast, damn it. If you want to talk about yourself, then I suggest you fire it up and do the same thing. I don't know. I mean, really, I think it's relatable. I have some stories to tell. Some of them are okay. Some of them are not so okay. But geez, really? All right. Too much time talking about myself. Really? Okay, here's another one. Dave, love the podcast. Thinking that maybe you should talk about grass more and some agronomy stuff because we all know that you're a great agronomist. Great comment. I'm not going to mention the name of the person that said this, but we're going to talk about grass. We're definitely going to talk about grass. I mean, grass is just everywhere, right? It's just in all of our psyche and all of our DNA. And yes, we're going to do some agronomy. I have a couple of things that I want to, well, here's another email that kind of gets to that. Hey, Dave, I'm wondering if you would think about having Micah Woods on as a guest of the Turfgrass Zealot Project. Yes. Yes. I think Dr. Micah Woods and I would be an extraordinarily fun podcast, and I've been kind of waiting on that. And he has agreed to do it. Oh, we probably would just, I don't know, man. I mean, I disagree with some stuff that he's been working on, and I agree with some stuff that he's been working on. Some of it has actually changed my thinking. So for me, it's like, that's one I got to prep for pretty hard, but I'm super excited about that. So yes, we're going to talk about grass. Yes, we're going to have some grass type guests on, you know, and I really, no knock against Frank Rossi, because I love what he's doing on the other side of TurfNet Radio. But I'm just not going to have every guest that comes on that's going to talk about grass is not going to be a PhD. I mean, I'm sorry. That's just not how it's going to work. I mean, I want to talk to supers. I want to talk to innovators. I want to talk to people in the industry that are doing cool stuff. And I, you know, we'll get to, I'm just going to wait. I'm going to bite my tongue on the it didn't happen unless it happened in research idea. But believe me, I'm going to be weighing in on that subject. All right, here's another email. Dave, we know you're a bass player. Are you playing much? What's going on? No, I'm not playing much. I'm not playing much at all. I had a little bit of studio work that I did for somebody. It was just minor. And it's actually funny. I mean, one of my basses has actually played more than I have. I loaned it to a friend who was doing some studio project work with it and stuff because it's a vintage, really cool early 1970s Fender P bass, and it has a tone that's extraordinary. So that got lent out. Recently I've been trying to learn the 5-string bass. I actually have been spending some time working out with 5 strings, and I have this pretty cool 5 that's a Warwick 5-string, and it's called the Dirty Blonde, and I've been playing the Dirty Blonde some, so that's been awesome. All right, well, look, that's the emails that we've been getting. I welcome all of your emails. I mean, happy to read something that you, maybe you want to send me something that you'd like just some anonymous talk about. You can do that. You can just send me an email. It's turfgrasszealot@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. It's @turfgrasszealot. Pretty easy. When I come back, we're going to be back with our two guests. We're going to start with Chris Tritabaugh from Hazeltine National Country Club, and we are going to talk to Scott Hess from Spark SMG. This is the Turfgrass Zealot Project, and I'm Dave Wilbur, the Turfgrass Zealot, and you're listening to us on TurfNet Radio.
The Turfgrass Zealot Project is presented by Clingstone, the original patented liquid-applied bunker barrier. Clingstone has been stopping sand contamination, eliminating erosion, and stabilizing bunker faces for over 15 years. Nobody else can say that. For more information, visit clingstone.com.
Well, I'm here today with Chris Tritabaugh from Hazeltine National. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm really glad that you could join me because it sounds like something's going on in the background. Want to tell me what's up?
Well, we're blowing out our irrigation system today. And, you know, this is kind of it uses minimal brain power, so I thought I might as well do a podcast with Dave Wilbur while I'm blowing out the irrigation system.
That's pretty awesome.
Not that a podcast with you requires minimal brain power.
Well, I was going to say, I'll try not to be too rough on you. How about that?
Good.
You know, so that you can watch sprinkler heads spew gases.
Yep.
So, well, listen, if you haven't, if you want to know more about Chris Tritabaugh, we did an episode of the Renovation Report a while back, and you can go back and take a look at that, or take a listen to that, I should say, and hear a little bit about Chris's background and some things that he has going on at Hazeltine National, including there's some kind of event coming up, isn't there, Chris? What is that? Like soon, right? Like,
yeah, right. Ryder Cup. So,
They
tell me it's big.
What's the number of days? Are you counting the days?
I'm not counting the days. I know it's, you know, we just passed the 11 month mark. So,
so you don't have one of those counters on your phone that says,
I don't have a counter. I probably should. That's probably something I should have in the shop, but I don't know. I'm maybe too low key for that kind of thing.
That's
so
pretty awesome that you can be that low key. Well, Chris, I'm glad that you joined me today. And what I want to get to right away today is I want to talk to you a little bit about, there was a discussion on the TurfNet forums a while back where you said some really cool stuff about the idea of work and work-life balance and all that sort of stuff. And you definitely put forward some philosophy that you have about how you handle things at Hazeltine. And I really wanted to talk to you about that today. So are you up for that discussion? For sure?
Totally.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about where that came from for you, you know, and maybe just we'll kind of get into the specifics, but I want to know in general, you know, you definitely didn't hesitate when that subject came up.
Well, you know, I think for me, I mean, if you actually go to the, if you look up the range that a millennial is, I was born in 77, so I'm 38.
Yeah.
I think I technically fit into that category. I don't know exactly. It's real close, like borderline.
Yeah, like you're just outside of it, actually.
Yeah.
The technical, you know, is 80 to 2000.
Okay.
But
all right,
there's a little bit of, you know, like I'm barely a Gen Xer, you know, that kind of thing.
So, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I understand where these millennials and the attitude that, you know, they supposedly have the negative attitude towards work. I think I understand that, and I think I get it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You know, when I was, let's see, how can I preface this? You know, this is an industry that sort of, in a way, prides itself on the amount of hours we work. Uh-huh. Oh, I work 80 hours a week. I worked 100. I'm there 50 hours a week in the winter. I read that somewhere. Like, yeah. What the hell?
Yeah.
You know, And I don't want to be like that. I mean, there's no, you know, I don't want to, as a superintendent, as an employee, when I was an assistant and I worked for, and I think if he's, I'm going to say this because I think if he listened to it, I think he'd be fine with this because I'm only telling the truth.
Okay.
I worked for a guy who was, you know, very traditional, and that was sort of his thing. Like the more you work, the more you know, your members valued you and that sort of thing. And I hated it. I hated being there that much. I hated not knowing when the end of my day was going to come.
Right.
And I, you know, I hated the fact that I couldn't, you know, ask when the end of the day was going to be for fear of being ridiculed for not wanting to work, you know, which wasn't the case. But sometimes it's like, I got friends that I'd like to do something with tonight. And are we going to be done at 4 o'clock, you know, or are we going to work?
Right.
And so when I got to be in a position where, you know, I was the guy in charge, I remembered those things and remembered how that made me feel and what I liked about it, what I didn't like about it.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, I'm not going to do it that way.
Yeah.
I'm going to give people an opportunity to, you know, I'm going to be consistent. The guys are going to know, you know, when their day is going to be done.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to work in a manner that, you know, rather than saying, we have to work 80 hours a week to produce a really great golf course, I'm going to go, we don't want to work 80 hours a week to produce a really great golf course. So how are we going to go about doing it without working 80 hours a week, right, and take so that mentality towards it.
So it's like working on efficiency.
That's the way I try to look at it. Is let's be as efficient as possible, mm-hmm. get in here and get done, get the course prepped. And then when we're done, we go home. Right. And I don't think there's any shame in that. You know, I think that's another thing. Our industry has this, like it's shameful to leave at 3 o'clock. Right. You know, I mean, that's ridiculous.
All right. So here's the question that I know a lot of people are thinking right now, Chris, is, you know, what about that Saturday or that Sunday, you know, where it gets hot and the wind picks up? Speaking of wind. And, you know, like, do you cover that in your scheduling, or, you know, do you have somebody out there kind of watching greens and just being around the place, or how do you guys do that? Or is your place, you know, doesn't necessarily, some places don't require that.
Well, and I think that's part of it. So with us, you know, we are a bent grass course. We have bent grass fairways, we have bent grass greens, mm-hmm. we have, you know, predominant, our short surfaces are bent grass. So that covers us in that way.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, I think that's something that can be covered in your preparation for it. Okay. Figure out how it is. And if you are a golf course that is requiring extended hours on a Saturday or a Sunday or mm-hmm. a day during the week, then figure out a way to do that efficiently, and, you know, figure out a way to do it with guys so that, you know, your guys aren't, it's not a 15-hour day for your guys, but maybe you have a split shift, or maybe you do it, you know, so it's 2 8-hour shifts. I just think there's rather than like be caught up in this dogma of turf management being an 80-hour week and you start at, you know, the crack of dawn and you're there until dark. Yeah. Why not figure out a better way to do it?
Well, and I guess I see a lot of that with like, are we going to use the word millennials? I guess we will. But certainly with some younger superintendents who are saying, look, I have to have a life here. Mm-hmm. And I can also be connected to the golf course while I'm off property in a lot of ways. You know, I can log into the irrigation system if I need to. I can text my people.
Yep.
You know, club management people can text me or reach me because I got the phone in my pocket everywhere I go. And that didn't exist in, you know, the late 80s when I was kind of coming up in the business, right?
I mean,
you know, you were off property, you were out of touch, period. And I think that's where a lot of that came from. Right.
And I think you're right. And I think a lot of that has changed. You know, I can set the irrigation system from home. I can stay communicating. I can stay in touch with my guys. But I think that's another thing. You have to hire people, and you have to have people that you trust so that when you're not there, you can go, well, I know that things are okay because the guys that I trust are there looking after it.
Right.
But then treat those people in such a manner that they have a time that you're getting, the same kind of thing, the same kind of recharge time that you're getting, so that they can get away and not have to think about things, mm-hmm. you know, as well. And I think that's just as important.
So what do you say sometimes to the guy who just likes being at the golf course? I mean, do you sometimes have to kind of send these guys home and say, hey, look, whether you believe it or not, you got to go take care of this.
Well, yeah, I think that's a good thought, because, you know, I've seen, I guess I've never dictated to somebody that you can't be here.
Okay.
You know, I've had guys and assistants who like to be there, are single, and are happy to come in and hang out and be around. Uh-huh. You know, I look at that and go, if a person's going to make that choice and that's what they're going to do without me saying you need to do that, then they're in a place mentally where that's, mm-hmm. they're able to handle that.
So and it's their choice, right?
It's their choice. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. I love that a lot. So, Chris, all of this dovetails into the conversation about, you know, talent underneath us and the role of the assistant, the second assistant, the irrigation person, you know, whatever the particular club or course, you know, calls the people underneath the superintendent. And, you know, we're seeing a pretty high burnout rate in that part of the world. And you talked about that a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
You want to give us some thoughts on where you were coming from there?
Well, I look at when I was an assistant, I think, you know, I got my superintendent job. That was, I started in 2007, was my first year as a superintendent.
Okay.
And I think for me, that came at the right time. I had just gotten married. You know, eventually we were going to have a family. That was something we wanted to do early.
Yeah.
Had I been an assistant and not gotten that job and remained an assistant, I think I would have burned out. I think I would have found something else to do because the long hours, and not so much the long hours, but the not knowing that became,
right. That's what that I hear.
Became difficult. And, you know, I even, as a superintendent, I've gotten better at that over the 9 years, is being more consistent in that regard and letting, having it so that my wife knows roughly what time I'm going to be home, roughly the days that I'm not going to work. And so she can plan for that. So she knows that I'm almost always going to be home by 5 o'clock, other than nights when I have a meeting. And she knows that I'm almost all, but it was two times this year, I'm not going to work on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And she can count on that. And when I got to the point that I was consistent with those things, I saw her attitude towards my time away from work be just that much better.
Uh-huh.
You know, uh-huh. I see a lot, you know, women who are married to superintendents are, you know, I guys praise their wives all the time and say, you know, she's so understanding of what I do and all that. And that's great. And I'm not, you know, disparaging that in any way.
Sure.
But my wife is a stay-at-home mom with two girls who are a lot of work. When I'm at home with my girls for 3 hours, I'm completely wiped out. So right. I look at it and I go, I need to be as respectful to her and to her needs and to what she's doing as she is to mine.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's important.
Yeah. And so, you know, we have this situation where, and I know when I was an assistant superintendent, you know, I wasn't making very much money. I mean, I was making, you know, it was okay, right? It was a job.
Mm-hmm.
Worked a ton of hours. Partly because I wanted to. You know, I was one of those guys that just wanted to be at the golf course.
Yep.
Nobody was necessarily telling me I had to be there. But it sure, like, there were some days where it's like when I would talk to other friends who were in other businesses and stuff who were working far less than I was,
yep,
making a heck of a lot more than I was. And I was like, ooh, did I make the right decision here?
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing a lot of that, I think.
Well, and so... So one of the things that really, you know, drives me nuts is this idea that because you might have somebody who works for you that feels that way, that looks at it and goes, well, wait a minute, I have friends who I can't go out to dinner with my friends. I can't go to a movie with my friends because I might have to work until 5 o'clock.
Right.
And that is somehow a negative, that's perceived as a negative trait of that person. That's what really upsets me.
So what you're saying is that because that person gets looked at is there's something wrong with him or her because they want to have a life.
Right. So I have not just in general, I'm being vague here, but you know, I have an assistant who, you know, as a superintendent X, my assistant Y he drives me crazy because he always wants to know when he's going to be done. And he makes plans with his friends to go out to dinner at 5 o'clock in the evening and go to a movie. And I can't stand it because he's always going to be, that's perceived to be a negative in so many regards, you know, that's some kind of a bad thing. And I think that that's not right. I think it shouldn't be a negative. That's something that as a superintendent, there's no reason why we can't work and plan and do things efficiently enough so that if an assistant wants to be done at 4 o'clock,
yeah,
he's done at 4 o'clock, you know?
Yeah.
That's my feeling. I know there's a lot of people who don't agree with that. And frankly, I don't really care. you know, this is the way I do it and it's successful. And I've got a staff who really works hard all the time. I mean, we're here in November and we are rocking and rolling. We've got tons of stuff going on.
Yep.
And either these guys are really faking it well, or they really are genuinely not burned out. They're happy to be here every day.
And one of the things that you've said is that happy factor, right?
Yep.
You've said that you guys have a good time at work.
You know? Yep.
And that's important to you. And I see a lot of golf courses. You know, there's a lot of different cultures at golf courses. You know, when you drive in the gate at the shop, you learn a lot just by watching for a second. And I see a lot of cultures where there's a lot of unhappy guys wandering around.
Yeah.
I mean, aren't happy guys more productive at the end of the day?
Absolutely. And, you know, I kind of tell everybody that right away. I tell the interns that come here and people that we hire, and I go, look, we want you to have a good time. Almost above all else, enjoy being out here. That's why you started doing this. That's why you working on a course somewhere near your hometown. That's probably what made you think, I want to do this for a career. That's probably the reason why somebody started to do that.
Right. Yep.
And why wouldn't you want to continue that? Sorry, my assistant came over and was making some. I lost my train of thought.
That's all good.
Get back on it here. so, you know, the point is that if guys come in and they know that they're going to have a good time, they know they're going to get consistency from their leaders, from their managers, and they know that when the day's done, the day's done. Yeah. I think those things go a long way to creating an environment that people really enjoy. And, you know, the other thing is I don't take myself seriously in any way, shape or form. I'm just a guy who has been fortunate to get a job that I have. Mm-hmm. I love it. But I'm just a small town kid who really got kind of lucky to be where I am. And I don't look at myself as being any more important than, you know, anybody else because I'm here and because I do what I do. So
you don't mind being one of the guys a little bit?
No, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important. Is a lot of times we see superintendents separating themselves and then they wonder why everybody's not behind them, you know?
And I think
it's a leadership thing. Yeah.
And I think I think it's okay to have some, humility might not be the right word, but have some vulnerability with your staff.
Okay.
You know, I feel like, you know, show them that you're a human, that you're a sports fan, you're a dad, you're a person who cares about other things and, you know, that you can be wrong. And that they might be able to be right about something that you guys, you disagree on. I think, you know, being able to show vulnerability in a controlled manner, not, you know, you don't want to be the pushover, but if your guys feel like he's really one of us, he's not trying to overpower us or keep us under his thumb. You're going to get a good staff. You're going to get a staff that's really going to work hard and enjoy what they're doing.
Okay. So what that partly means too, Chris, is that you're happy. Right? You're having a good time.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, yours is a pretty big job. I mean, you get the Ryder Cup coming up, and you guys have been through a bunch of renovation work, which we talked about before, and you're still having a good time, right? I mean,
I do. I enjoy it every day. I enjoy coming in. But you know what? I'm not ashamed to say that when the weekend comes or when a day comes that I'm not going to be here, I enjoy that. I enjoy not being here and enjoy not thinking about the place and enjoy getting that mental break. Whether it's, I think it's, I can go home, and I've not always been good at this. I've really gotten better in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. To go home, to forget about it, to be with my kids, to be with my wife, and to generally not let, you know, what's going on at work or my feelings about work impact my interaction with them. It still happens, but I'm much better about it than I used to be.
It's hard, man. I mean, I remember I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, having dinner with John Zielinski and his wife when he was at Southern Hills, and the sky opened up and it started to rain harder than I've ever seen it rain ever. And we're sitting next to the window, you know, in this restaurant, and John can't concentrate. He can't even eat, right? Because he just knows that something bad is going to go on. And the next day he walked into, you know, I think they got like, you know, 8-9 inches of rain that night. And his shop was underwater, and it was a disaster, you know, and he knew it was going down. And it's hard, isn't it, not to be completely distracted by that kind of stuff?
It is.
It's an extreme thing, but...
No, but it happens to me. I'm not going to say that it doesn't. I mean, there are certainly nights where, I mean, it's clear that my mind is elsewhere. And, you know, a lot of times my wife she likes to say, you know, how come you're so crabby about, you know... And I said, well, look, when we're having people come over to stay at the house, how do you feel about it? You get stressed, you get crabby. People are coming. They're going to judge your house. They're going to judge your cleaning, your cooking, your all that stuff. Sure. And that's stressful to you. I said, now I'm at a place where I'm going to have multiple hundreds of people come out to the course tomorrow. And every one of them is going to judge the way it looks, the way it plays, the way it, you know, smells, all that stuff. And that can be a little stressful once in a while. And, you know, she doesn't particularly like that comparison, but
she doesn't like
I think
comparison
it's
at all,
no, but probably. I think it's apt. And I, you know, it's, It's you're right. There are times where you just can't leave it behind. That's the nature of this job.
You think the future of our business is kind of in trouble as far as bringing up young talent these days?
I think it could be. I mean, and I think some of it is I think it's from both sides. So I think the students have really focused their attention on trying to get jobs at top courses.
Right.
And I think that in a way, I understand why they do it. I mean, I don't fault anyone for that.
Sure.
But I think what it's doing is it's making the talent in the industry the top end. It's very heavy on the top end. I mean, and you can see that if you go through the job postings on TurfNet, there's tons of sort of middle range assistant jobs open.
Yep.
You know, and then, everybody, because nobody's going after them because everybody wants to be an assistant at a big club, mm-hmm. understandably. Mm-hmm. And so what they're doing is they're going in at the bottom end at the big clubs, and then they're just working their way up. And you can't blame the guys at the big clubs for just taking the next guy because they've worked with somebody for 2 or 3 years. They know what they're like. They know how they're going to operate in their philosophy and in their operation, and they bring them right up. So those jobs never really open, but yet everybody's kind of waiting for that, you know?
Why do you think, Chris, this is a great question for your age group. Why do you think that, you know, once upon a time, back kind of when I was getting in the business, there were a lot of career assistants. There were a lot of guys that were kind of, you know, they've been assistant superintendents for a while and they really didn't necessarily aspire to a superintendent's job, at least not right away. You know, now it seems like everybody's kind of on this fast path, you know. I want to get out of school. I want to do my internship. I want to get a great assistant's job. And then I should be handed a superintendent's job.
Mm-hmm. You know,
2, 3, 4 years. What's wrong with being an assistant for a while, you know, and really learning the ropes? Is that something that is just lost on people?
That's a good question. I don't know if I know the answer. You know, that might be the millennial thing. Like, you know, everybody wanting to always this upward mobility, you know, and maybe that's a negative. I mean, that might be, I think, you know, it's a little bit of a shallow way of looking at it. You know, like I'm only going to be happy if I'm at the top level of my industry, you know?
I know a lot of guys that got to the top and said, this isn't as cool as I thought it was.
I know. But you know, that's the mentality of the students that are coming out today. Now, I don't have the answer on how you can change that. I mean, how you can get a guy to be happy as an assistant at, you know, a smaller club or a superintendent at a smaller club, or be happy to be an assistant for 10 years. I don't know. You know, I mean, I think changing the sort of the paradigm of the business, in that, you know, it's not mm-hmm. going to be underpaid and overworked. You know, maybe it's reasonably played and reasonably worked, and then maybe those type of jobs, those career assistant positions, become more desirable to
right.
people.
They could be a good thing and not mm-hmm. necessarily something where the guy feels like he's a doormat if he
right.
you know, gets trampled on all the time. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's pretty cool.
But at the same time, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in, but you know, the mentality of the club too. So the leadership of the club has to be willing to accept that, and you know, that's changed too. You know, yeah. people are, you know, it's sort of like the coaching ranks in sports. It's like the flavor of the day. And, you know, what have you done for me lately? I mean, there's no doubt that those are problems within our industry, and, you know, how you solve them. I don't know that I have the answer.
You know, I read Mike Rowe a lot, the dirty jobs guy, mm-hmm. you know, the TV guy. And Mike is very big on the whole idea that, you know, that professions don't always have to be white collar, and that trade, you know, that the trades and vocational type things are really in big trouble, you know,
yep.
and that there's a lot of people that don't know how to change a tire and,
yep.
you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I'm reminded of a story a superintendent told me one time about a guy who wanted an assistant's job with him, a second assistant's job, you know, which was essentially an internship kind of deal, and had never driven a stick shift before. And he's like, dude, I don't know what to say. You know, like, you've got some work to do here, you know?
Hold on 1 second, Dave.
Sure. Anyway, I'm going to talk about that for a minute while Chris is doing his thing.
I'll shut it down and wait, sort of wait.
But this is so awesome. Chris is blowing
up
the irrigation system. And away we go.
All right. Okay. I'm back.
Now, that is turf head stuff, man. I love it. It's so good. But anyway, the whole idea that vocation is not a bad thing. Learning a trade is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, I look at that too, and you know, that comment, let's call it the generic comment regarding the millennials, like, well, these guys don't know how to shovel. You know, they've never shoveled. They've never had to dig a hole from, you know, here to there and back again. Uh-huh. But can a guy not be taught that? I mean,
Absolutely.
I think they can. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's this idea that, well, just because this kid grew up in the suburbs and he hasn't worked on a golf course, he hasn't worked hard in his life, that he can't shovel like that. And you know what? Maybe there are some of them that just aren't cut out for it. But I think, you know, you can also, you know, there's horses for courses a little bit. And, you know, I'm not trying to sound like I have all the answers here, because in some cases I definitely do not. But I just think, as an industry, we can be better at working with the people that we have and working with this next supposed lesser generation of employees than we are at just saying, you know, they're no good because they don't know how to work a shovel. So forget it. Yeah, they're a lost cause.
All these millennials, you know, they just, you know, all they can do is text.
Right.
You know, I hear that from somebody told me that one day, and I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, we don't even use radios out here. We have text message all the time. So,
right. The radios are like secondary to the text message.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So, well, Chris, man, I appreciate your insights to all this, because I do think our business is challenged a little bit. One, to that there has to be some awareness about quality of life, you know, and I was super guilty of it. Like, work a million hours, work my guys a million hours. You know, I wasn't always good about saying what was coming up, although I was a bit of a planner, so I could, you know, I used to schedule that stuff, you know, pretty hard and tell people, yep, hey, we're gonna do a late evening, you know, and stuff. For me personally, I think I was at the golf course a lot when I didn't need to be. Mm-hmm. Because there was this perception that I needed to be seen, or I needed to just kind of be around just in case.
Right.
Well, again, we communicate differently. There's a lot of different ways to get information, you know, now. And I think things are changing. And I'll tell you what, if we don't change with the world and our business doesn't change with us, we're in trouble.
Huh. Yeah.
Right?
I agree.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good. Well, listen, Chris, I think you better get back to blowing the irrigation system out.
Well, I might be hogging air here, because my assistant just came up and I had to stop because he said they're losing pressure on their end. So
the constant maybe my battle.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's funny because it seems like everywhere you go, the superintendent says, all right, now you can only open up two stations per, you know, for your own. Each guy can only open up two stations. And then you come up and the superintendent, of course, has eight open, you know.
Right, he's got a bunch of heads going.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm proud to say I don't do that. I stick to my two heads.
Okay, so how do you guys do it? Do you put a one big compressor, or do you have a bunch of small compressors that you tow around? And
we have one big compressor, so the whole thing stays open. We don't do any valving.
Okay.
And we start at the pump house, which is relatively central located, and we work our way out towards the outsides. And then usually there'll be it's a 2-day deal. So we'll blow it all out. We'll shut it down. Everything will settle out. And then we'll go back through everything the next day.
And then do it again. Yeah.
Yep. So last year we didn't do that because we were rushing to beat a snowstorm. Uh-huh. So we went on a Sunday. We went all day and we went through it 2 or 3 times just in one shot. We never shut it down and let it settle out. And we had a mainline spot that ended up, you know, getting some water settled and froze.
Right.
So.
Oh man, I don't miss that. Let me tell you something. I don't miss the because I was stupid and I used to just wait as long as possible.
Yeah.
You know, and then half the time we'd end up blowing out in the snow. And man, if you don't have anything marked, you know, you're out digging for that quick coupler, which you know where it is until it's time to find it.
Yeah, until it's covered with snow, right? Yeah. Then you can never find it.
Yeah, exactly. All right, buddy. Well, we'll let you get to it. Thank you so much, Chris, for your insights. And Chris Trittlebaugh from Hazeltine National. Say goodbye, Chris.
Thanks, Dave. This has been a pleasure. Happy to do it anytime.
Okay.
So.
Thank you. We'll be speaking with you soon. I know it.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Have a great day.
The Turfgrass Zealot Project is presented by Clingstone, the original patented liquid applied bunker barrier. Plingstone has been stopping sand contamination, eliminating erosion, and stabilizing bunker faces for over 15 years. Nobody else can say that. For more information, visit Plingstone.com.
Well, thanks for being with me on the Turfgrass Zealot Project. And I, you know, I'm always going to be full of surprises. And I got a great surprise today. I have Scott Hess with me. Hello, Scott. Say hello.
Hey, Dave Wilbur. How are you?
So, Scott, I want to tell a little bit of our story for a minute.
Okay.
Because I think it'll be cool and it'll be timely for what we're going to talk about today. I mean,
okay.
First of all, Scott Hess he's kind of a wheel, you know? He has this great title. It's Executive Vice President of Human Intelligence for a company called Spark. It's an advertising and media type thing. Am I right about that, Scott?
Yep. We're part of the giant Publicis network, and we're a full-service media agency, so we kind of plan and buy media for companies like Taco Bell and Ace Hardware, about 50 different companies, and we spend about 50 companies, we spend about $4 billion on their behalf.
See, so now we know that we're talking to somebody, right?
That's right.
All right. But I want to take us back to, I don't know, what, 1992, 93, somewhere in that neighborhood. There was this cool online conferencing thing called The Well. It was really the very first kind of cool virtual community thing that was going on. I hate using that word, Scott, but I think for people, you know, it would make sense. And
it was like a text-based Facebook, but with only, you know, several hundred people on it instead of the entire planet.
Right. And it was like this one step up from like the bulletin board culture that was kind of going on. You know, there was actually, you know, conferencing and more interaction, and it was much more human. And the reason I joined The Well is because I needed an email address, and it was like one of the ways to get an email address, because I was doing some stuff with some university people and they said, you got to get an email address.
Yeah.
This is dating that whole thing, right?
And well, so, email, I mean, having an email address was super exotic. It was like, you know, making your own car or something.
Right. Yeah. It was like, oh, how do I do, you know, I had to do all this research and somebody said, you need to join The Well. And so that's why I got a Well account, was because I was thinking I just need an email address. I had no idea that there was this whole conferencing thing going on. And all
jeez, I mean, that's amazing, because you took to it like few people. I mean, it's funny that you accidentally ended up there, because you were one of the most unbelievably prolific people I came across.
And I was going to say the same thing about you. I mean, there was this guy, Scott Hess, who was living in Chicago, and we were the same age, and we had some of the same interests, and we liked the same music, and there was this conference on The Well called the Gen X Conference for Generation yep. X. And a lot of Well members were a little bit older. You know, they were kind of deadheads and baby boomers and stuff. So we built yep. our own island, you know, we built our yep. own world. And there were some really cool voices there. I mean, really cool people, you know, writers that were just getting started, and creative types, and nerds and geeks. And oh man, I mean, it was like, I felt like my eyes got opened, you know, for the first time since I was born, when I started up with all that. And then
I mean, I remember totally being, so I worked in downtown Chicago by day and everything with all these smart people at Anderson Consulting. And that was all fine and good. But at night, in a dark room on a computer terminal with just, you know, text characters,
yeah.
was where the world, like all of a sudden the world came to life for me, because the people on this thing were so curious, so smart, so diverse. It was yeah. kind of like my daytime in the real world was in black and white, and at night in the dark by myself was in Technicolor, just because the ideas that were flying around.
That was the whole thing. Yeah. So
it was amazing.
So when people talk to me about social media and all that sort of stuff, I mean, I almost grab this kind of elitist kind of attitude, you know, because like, ooh, I was a member of The Well, and Wired Magazine said we were the world's most, you know, influential online community and all this different stuff. And we were right there. We were right in the middle of it. And
accidentally, too, for the most part. The thing that was incredible was the kind of people that showed up there together at the same time. I mean, it wasn't easy to navigate there. It was hard work. It's not like Facebook's easy now. You had to sort of have this will to get there and discover and how to use it and everything. And the people that did it were self-selecting, interesting, incredible people.
Yeah, it was like,
I guess it's patting ourselves on the back, except for us.
Back in the caveman days, you don't know how hard the struggle was, you know, kind of thing. But that's...
Yep. Yeah.
It was like work. I mean, you had to learn some Unix and some other things to, you know, to make some things run and use the tools. So Scott Hess was, there was this guy who could really write. And I mean, Scott, your writing was so cool. And, you know, he had a creative writing background and he just had a great worldview. And you and I have met in person twice.
Is that right?
Right. But we've been friends for a long time. Like,
yeah, you're a very familiar figure for me. But I know we went out for sushi, and I think we went maybe to the Zeitgeist one time. But it's funny, you're a fairly, for somebody that I've met twice, I feel like I've met you, you know, every week for most of the last 20 some years.
Yeah, I mean, we know about each other's life events and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And you know, that's pretty cool. So
it is.
So we're okay. So Scott, I want to get to it, and I want to kind of talk about the reason that I wanted to have you here today. You know, Scott, you're becoming really the real expert on kind of the millennial generation and in generational marketing and all that sort of stuff, you know? And so what I wanted to do today was talk to you about the millennial generation. And can you define that for us so that everybody knows like the technical part of that?
Sure. Easy way to understand it is that generational theory is this soft science that kind of looks at when people were born and figures out that, wow, they have a lot of things in common. So, you know, aside from being born at the same time, they have a worldview that moves with them through life. And that worldview, if you know it, is kind of a little code for if you're a marketer that wants to develop products or communicate with them, if you're a government that's trying to talk to them, if you're a big organization of some kind trying to make big bets, generational theory is a way to generalize about an audience based on when they were born. And the millennial generation is referring to a group that's born roughly between 1980 and 2000, the millennium. So you're talking about, give or take, about 80 million Americans.
Okay. Okay, 80 million Americans. And is that, I mean, are those boundaries a little, can they be a little bit fuzzy? Like I was talking to a guy earlier today and he said he was born in 1977, but he thinks of himself as a millennial. Is that
cool for him to do that? Like I said, yeah, generational theory is soft science. There's no baby new year for the generation, you know, like at midnight, the first millennial baby was born. So, you know, if you're born in 77, you're probably what would, Neil Howe is the leading living generational theorist. He would call you a cusper because you're sort of on the cusp of the end of a generation at the beginning of the next. And you might, if you had older brothers, be more like the previous generation, or if you're the oldest in a family of younger brothers and the gravity in your family is younger and the culture that's in your house all the time is younger, you might be a little bit more like the next generation.
Right.
And so I worked for a big research company for 10 years before I got to the media agency. And one of the things that you see when you look at huge data sets is that, you know, if you look at a big study that's fielded year after year, you see that the changes, you know, societal changes, cultural changes happen somewhat glacially. And if I look at, you know, the year 2000 and then the year 2001, there's tiny little ticks. But if I look at from the year 2000 to the year 2011, all of a sudden, you know, from the remove of space, I can see things happening more quickly. So it makes a lot of sense that somebody in 77 might identify with some things that would be, you know, the next generation.
Okay.
It's almost like one of the metaphors I like to use is seasons. If you back out for winter, if you live in the Midwest where I live, is generally a pretty cold season. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that there aren't some days that are really warm and you throw your parka down on the ground and run around in your shirt sleeves. But generally, winter is cold. Just like generally, if I want to talk about millennials, I can tell you that the following things are likely true.
Okay.
One of the great landmines of generational theory is trying to figure out exact starts and stops of the generations. Another landmine is if you see an anomaly, your niece, your nephew, your cousin, your neighbor, your son or daughter, that's a little bit different than how I generalize, and you say, well, I'll throw it all out with the wash. Again, I mean, there's warm days in winter, and there's you know, cold days in summer.
Sure. Okay. So if you could lay out a couple of characteristics of millennials. So, I mean, we got the date part kind of together and the understanding, but in your research work with True before, you know, where you were for 10 years before, I mean, you guys really worked on what are these guys all about? right?
We had the best thing going because we basically had fielded a syndicated study for 30 years of people ranging in age from 12 to 29. So we really got to take a look at attitudes and values over time. We got to look at them in life stages. I got to see if, you know, preteens changed over the course of the life of the study. I got to see, you know, what things were intact as these guys grew, you know, from preteens to teens to, you know, young adults and whatnot. And the other thing we did was we fielded a ton of custom work. So I had this syndicated study, which was kind of the bully pulpit from which I'd go out and talk. But then companies like Coke and Pepsi and Nike and Adidas would hire us to go out and do very specific research in a category. So I'd be able to take what I knew in the syndicated study and what I was hearing in the field qualitatively and really come up with a pretty robust idea about who these guys were. So I'll give you one example of the kind of thing that we saw.
Okay.
We learned that millennials were extremely diversity positive. We certainly saw in the quantitative study that these guys would say, like, you know, my friend group includes X percentage of people that are different from me in terms of race or ethnicity. And we would see over the course of the study how much that had trended up, how much more common it became to have friends who were different from you. But we also then would hear, going out and doing a research for Nike or for, I did a bunch of research for Echo, the hip-hop brand, ECKO, and I would notice that from market to market, these guys would be introducing their friends, not hiding the things that were different about them, but accentuating them. Like, they'd say, like, here's Dave, he's my Korean friend. This is Josh, he's my Jewish friend. That's Susie, she's our nerd friend. They would be explicitly, you know, celebrating, like, wearing it almost like a badge, how their friends were different.
Sure.
We saw in the data that was actually a departure from the previous generation. And we also knew, you know, in this particular instance, I knew from growing up in that time that this idea of the breakfast club, where there were these harsh divisions between cliques that people kind of clung to, we saw that was eroding. And we saw, you know, and you started to see even in media, like, a show like Glee stands in such stark contrast to The Breakfast Club, where it's like diversity is our strength as opposed to, you know, diversity is what separates us. And so we called this, we used to make up these grand themes. Uh-huh. We called it Centergy, C-E-N-T-E-R-G-Y, which was the idea that there was a kind of movement towards the mainstream embracing the fringe. So it was no longer about me and the people just like me hanging out together. It was really about enthusiastically seeking out diversity and wearing it as a badge. So I think it's a truly defining characteristic of the millennial generation. We had a client, Abercrombie & Fitch, for whom we said, look, you're going to have to be a much bigger tent Abercrombie going forward, or you're going to be in trouble with these guys. It can't be a clubhouse for cool kids in the mall. They were loath to change, and I think they've suffered for that fact. Synergy is a big one. I also think something that continues from the millennials through what I call the post-generation, which are the next group coming, is a redefined relationship with their parents, where they went from command and control parents who wielded authority to, for millennials, it's much more about their parents being almost friends and cheerleaders, encouraging them. As one young woman said in research, my mom is a cheerleader who helps me be my very best. And this sounded so different than you know, the Gen X notion of parents. It looked different than what we saw on television when parents were portrayed. And we noticed that in the culture all of a sudden that families like the Osbournes and the Lohans and the Simpsons were revealing an entirely different, almost peer-like relationship between parents.
Yeah. Interesting. Really big difference.
And their kids, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about work ethic and work for a minute, because one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on today was because there's been a lot of discussion on turfnet.com. There's a forum there, Scott.
Yep.
And there's been a lot of conversation about millennials in the workplace and how that's gone well and how that's gone not so well for some people. And, you know, you haven't been privy to those conversations, but I'll bet you that you know quite a bit about what's working and what isn't working in the workplace for that particular group of people.
Yeah, so I'm in an agency that's grown from 60 people to 400 in the last 3.5 years.
Wow.
And the bulk of our growth, I mean, God, we've added 340 people. Uh-huh. The bulk of that growth, 80%+ of that has been people that are under 30.
Wow.
So, wow. Millennial.
Must be fun at work.
It's great. I love it. It's sometimes it's amazing because I forget that I'm the old guy because I'm surrounded by such youth.
Do they think? But of also you there as are the times. Do they think? Do they think of you as the old guy, or how do you?
You know what I get told, and you have to be honest on these things because somebody will Google this and read and listen to it and play it back and tell me like that's not true. So right. Yeah, I think there's no denying that the 49-year-old guy with like the white beard is the old guy, but I do get occasionally told that I'm the cool old guy.
Cool guy.
So right. I'm like kind of like that uncle that you don't mind hanging out with. That's not quite your dad,
right? Because you know how to skateboard and you know about music and those things are cool. Right.
But you also run the risk of being the douchey old guy that's clinging to his youth. So I'm always trying to make sure that I'm not the latter.
You want to be that guy. Yeah.
But here at Spark, one of the big things that we've done as we've grown is we've said, if you want to connect with millennials as employees and colleagues, you don't speak in words, you speak in culture.
Okay.
And so we know these guys are connected. We say there's a generation bridge, not a generation gap for these guys. So we actually just had last week on Friday our second Spark Parents Day where our employees literally invite their parents to come to work with them. We embrace their closeness. We teach the parents what their kids do here at work. We put on a massive program for them, and then we have one of the most rip-roaring happy hours you could ever imagine where it's like Parents Weekend at college, you know, brought to, into the workplace.
Right. Wow.
But there was an essay last week on LinkedIn where there was a woman, an HR professional on LinkedIn that said that parents don't belong in the workplace with their children. You know, it slows down their taking responsibility for themselves. We completely disagree. Our whole push here has been to understand who millennials are, what they value, and try and deliver it. We have the lowest turnover in our network, highest retention of employees, highest loyalty metrics in our culture survey that's done across Starcom MediaVest Group. And I think it's because we don't say, this is how work is, this is how it's always been done, and you millennials are going to put aside your childish ways and become adults. We actually try and understand what is the ethos of this generation and how can we remake work so that it feels better for them.
Oh, that's so cool. That's so cool.
It's a good place to be, right? It's really, and you know what? If, as an older person, if you just relax a little bit, it's amazing I think that millennials in the workplace are essentially demanding what we wished we could have said out loud and felt that we didn't have a right to.
Right, right.
And that's because they have more power.
Right, I get that.
They sit there with LinkedIn. They can see on their LinkedIn dashboard who's looked at their profile, whether those views are going up or down. They can get a sense of their marketability and how to connect with other people in the marketplace. I mean, this is scary for employers, but these guys, sure. We used to, how long did it take you to figure out, you know, who was in the Turfgrass network and where else you might be able to work and what their phone number was and if they had an email address? I mean, this was years of work for you.
It was, yeah.
And now that, you know, 5 weeks into this job, I guarantee that, you know, half the people that work here have connected with their peers at other media agencies. It's an organic process that happens almost instantly for these guys. As opposed to back in the day when you went inside the walls of an employer, you were locked in until you got let out for happy hour on Friday, you know?
Yeah.
Couldn't make long distance phone calls.
Right, right. Well, okay, and let's talk about the connectivity thing for a second, because, you know, one of the things that I hear, you know, from the people who are now our age, Scott, if you will.
Yes, older.
Older. You know, we're in a position of, you know, managing people or, you know, whatever we're doing. And there's some things that you hear, you know, like they've always got their phones in their hand. And yeah. They're always, you know, and they're so social and
yes.
All that sort of stuff. And I listened to an interview that you did and it was brilliant, man. I was thinking about this. When we were coming up in the workforce, when we were in our 20s.
Yeah.
I mean, you told this story about like waving to your friend, you know, across the street or whatever through the window or something. I mean, the connectivity was virtually non-existent, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. My one of my best friends from college and I got jobs at the same time in downtown Chicago, and as fate would have it, he was at like 33 West Washington, and I was at 69 West Washington. The buildings were on the south side of the street, but there was a street in between us. So we would at a pre-planned time, we would walk to the windows of these buildings, and I would look down on his floor, and he would look up to my floor, and we'd put our hand against the window as kind of a show of solidarity in the middle of the workday. And that was, but you know, I he didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have a cell phone. We didn't even have, he didn't have a laptop or desktop computers at the very beginning. Eventually we got the computers, but then when he got computers, he didn't have email. Then when he got email, it was, the social convention wasn't there to, like, you know, send a three letter acronym that stood for, you know, what's going on or something like that. I mean,
right.
The culture of being connected did not exist for us during the day. The workplace was an island.
Right. And so, so it's not hard to, when you hear it that way, it's not hard to think that, yeah, you know, we wouldn't necessarily understand the need for connectivity because it was not a need that we needed to have fulfilled when we were coming up in the workplace.
Yeah. It's almost like it's not even a need. That's the thing. It is innate. These guys aren't like, I am going to now look away from work and be connected with my friends and my Facebook account. Like I had a client.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a client at, she was at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy, a brilliant woman who went to Stanford. She had a master's degree from Stanford in like public policy or something. And she looked at me with horror in her eyes and said, my employees are on Facebook, and when I walk up to their desk, they don't even alt tab away.
They don't even, you know, hide the screen. Right.
Yeah. And yeah. I said, yeah, but Sarah, that's because they're not afraid of you seeing that. As far as they're concerned, an intermittent look at Facebook or Twitter or, you know, Snapchat on their phone or whatever they're doing, it's sort of part of the fabric of life now, just as when they're laying in bed at night, you know, watching Netflix and you send them an email or a text, they're going to respond to you then. They aren't perceiving work and life as two discrete things that, you know, never the twain shall meet. These are, to them, it's kind of this one big thing. Life and work are all part of the same thing.
Right. So
when I'm myself, I don't have to put on my special work uniform if I work in a, you know, most companies now. There are only a handful of industries where I have to dress up. Unless I'm behind the counter at a fast food place, the clothes I wear to work are pretty darn similar to the clothes I'm going to wear out after work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, one of the things I tell companies that I work with, that'll say, like, you know, we've got X, Y, and Z issues with millennials. I say, look, if you have rules, you've got to tell them those rules explicitly. If you're not allowed to wear headphones when you leave your desk or your cube and go to the copier, you got to tell them that, because you and I, when we walked into the workplace, we knew how to dress. We dressed like our dads dressed. We knew, you know, all the conventions of the workplace because they had been the same for our father and our father's fathers.
Okay.
None of those conventions are conventional anymore. So every workplace is a little different. So one of the main things I tell people is, if you have some hard and fast rules about when you got to show up, what you got to wear, what you're allowed to do when it comes to using different kinds of media in the workplace, you got to tell them explicitly because they don't know.
Right. Okay. Okay. That's awesome. I mean, that's amazing, because you're right. I mean, I learned that stuff from my dad, you know, like, you know, you got to dress a certain way. And there was stuff like that, you know, that was,
well,
just kind of.
I'm more of mornings family. Now. Yeah. I drop my boys off at the train. They take the train to, they're in like eighth grade and fifth grade, and they go to a private school. I drop them off in a blazer and a tie while I'm wearing jeans and high tops and a hoodie. And it's like, it's hilarious to me, just, you know, how much things have changed.
Oh, that's funny.
What? It is.
Yeah. And I'm sure. Well, yeah. I mean, that's got to make everybody feel funny. Right.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about this whole thing about, like, work hard, play hard. I mean, in your kind of generation of the Gen X kind of thing, that was the mantra, you know, work hard, play hard.
Which is basically saying, like, work sucks, but don't worry. Eventually we're going to play. We're going to make the playtime just as awesome as the work was sucky. You know, it was like work-life balance meant that, you know, work was horrible. So you need to at least spend a little bit of time with your kids so that you won't lose your mind. That work-life balance was like, you know, I don't know how we bought into this. It was at Anderson. It was always work hard, play hard, right. You know, work crazy hours, travel all the time. But then the partner will buy, you know, the cigar tray and the expensive after dinner drinks.
Right.
And we were like, well, then that makes everything okay. You know, and millennials come in and they're like, work-life integration. There's not work and then personal. It's all together. I'm going to be myself, dress myself, act myself, be my social media self all day long. And right. and that's just the way it is. It's a whole different expectation.
Right. Right. And so in a interview that I heard with you recently, you just kind of said that that whole concept is really, what did you use the word relic? You know,
I guess it's a relic. I mean, look, the reason that we as Gen Xers and boomers and stuff did a lot of the things we did is that, that we did what was possible. We didn't really have a choice. We couldn't be connected with our personal life while we were inside the walls of work. We had to punch in a special code to make a long distance phone call. And then we had to have an excuse that, like, you know, someone died or
and fill out the log. And like, I remember having to fill out the log.
Yeah, you feel, yes, I made a long-distance phone call today. It was a huge anomalous behavior. And so I think the entire backdrop or context that these guys move into the workplace in, whether it's technological or it's the social and cultural things that have accompanied technological change, are just different. And so I think a lot of bosses are like, this is how we've always done it. It's not a great justification. The reason we did it that way wasn't because it was considered. It was because it was the extent of what was possible at the time. And the realm of possibility has shifted starkly. And so, you know what? The rules and the culture of work are going to have to shift with it.
Well, and to play devil's advocate for what you just said, Scott,
yep.
I mean, isn't that just playing into the whole theory that, you know, everybody gets a trophy regardless of how well they perform? And, you know, that we're not necessarily, you know, asking people to stand out and do great things because it's easy for them to kind of melt into the cheese, so to speak, you know?
Yeah. So I see it differently than that. Okay. One of the things that I've been consistent with when I was at RollingStone.com or at True or now at Spark is I will tell my employees, like, here's what I care about. Once you've committed to a deadline, you have to meet it. If you have a client, or whether it's an internal or an external client, you need to thrill and delight them. If you meet your deadlines and you thrill and delight your clients, I'm not particularly concerned with exactly when you arrive. I'm not particularly concerned with the exact style that you bring to it. So I have people that arrive at different times. I have people that work longer and shorter. I have people that I really have no idea where and how the work is getting done. Mm-hmm. And so, But what I'm encouraging them to be is excellent. Hit your deadlines, thrill your clients, be excellent, but be excellent however you want to be. When I got to Anderson, I had to fill out a time report that literally broke down my time in 6-minute increments. So if I worked for 6 minutes, that was a 0.1. 12 minutes was a 0.2.
Sure.
I had to wear a dark suit with a light colored shirt and put on my jacket when I stood up from my desk. everything we had to do was in methodology binders that we had to learn at a university style setting in St. Charles, Illinois. That's just not going to fly as well with this generation. That is so. This is a generation that fact checks its professors at university and its bosses in the work during meetings and lectures.
Right.
We didn't do that. We couldn't.
We couldn't. We couldn't just run for the World Book Encyclopedia, right? And these guys can just pull up the phone and Google stuff. So.
This sense of possibility is so far beyond ours, and it's really, if you are able to light a fire under it, an incredibly powerful, great thing.
Okay. Okay. So.
So I think you actually don't ask everybody to be. Everybody gets a trophy and don't be excellent. I think you say, you know what, play to your strengths, be excellent to the extent of your ability, and I'm not going to tell you exactly how to do that. And so one of the things that I think that millennials have to bring into the workplace is this sense of I'm a problem solver and I'm not waiting for direction.
I mean, I hear everything that you're saying about millennials. I mean, there's hope for these guys, right? I mean,
yeah, I hope so. 80 million of them, but I want to write them all off.
There's hope for our future. And it sounds like to me what you're saying is that generating some understanding from all of us, quote unquote, old guys, can go a long way to making some really cool things happening, right?
Yeah, I mean, what I like to say a lot of time is, look, your millennial kids, employees, potential customers, you know, that you're trying to connect with, You certainly could think about how they're different from you and hold it against them, but I don't think it's going to get you where you want to go. You know, if you want to forge a more effective, more meaningful, more rich connection, what if you embrace the things that we know about them, their diversity, positivity, their you know, deep connection with their parents and their family, their innate faith that they have in being able to navigate to, you know, what's true and good and valuable. What if you actually embrace and celebrate those things about them and develop, you know, offerings and messages that reflect that? It's amazing what you, if you decide to make them into your friends and you have a great attitude towards them, how that comes back to you. Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed that the people are like, well, we know all these things about millennials, but we don't like it, so we're going to do the opposite thing. And then they're amazed and they're like, well, these millennials are terrible and I don't understand why they won't. You have to embrace what you know about them and rethink your offerings, your approach, you know, to meet them at least halfway, if not more.
Right.
It's amazing to me how profound the differences are once somebody decides to embrace the things they know about millennials as opposed to fight with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking about a friend of mine who hired a young guy to do some sales for him in our business,
yes,
in the turfgrass world. And he just didn't understand how that guy was approaching everything, right? It was like, what are you doing? Why aren't you in the office at certain times? What, you know, and then like all of a sudden he sees that this guy's building some relationships that he couldn't build. And
yeah,
that out of those relationships came some really cool things and then therefore some sales, right? Not a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, we had a situation where, our young interns, our sort of rising senior college interns were coming in and they were, all they cared about was, building out their LinkedIn profile. They were, you know, like, and everyone's like, well, that's terrible. It's just a credential. And it's like, yeah, but all right, let's think about this. Here's what you want them to do. What if you showed them in template what kinds of things, if they did X, Y, and Z, what you want them to do over the course of the summer, here's an example of the bullet points they could add to the LinkedIn profile. You know, summer internship with this company, learn the following things. And what if the internship kind of was structured almost as if it was a game where they were adding merit badges to their LinkedIn profile?
Wow.
We tried it. It was profoundly successful. These guys were like, I totally get it. This is awesome. We were letting them score points on the game that they wanted to play while they were actually also moving the needle in the game that we were playing. So, you know, it shouldn't be that hard to figure out that if you meet them, you know, and they're on their terms, it's going to help.
Awesome. That's good stuff, man. Well, listen, Scott, we're starting to get to the end of our time here. And I want to talk about your TED talk that has gotten what, like 250,000 views or whatever.
Yeah.
So tell me the title of that again.
It's called Millennials, Who They Are and Why We Hate Them.
And if you search Scott Hess and TEDx or TED Talk or whatever, that YouTube video is going to come up. And as far as I'm concerned, it's required watching for anybody.
I'm so happy that like 4 years after I did it, I still am getting just an amazing amount of inbound email, LinkedIn requests, and good comments on there. And I jump in and mix it up with people who make comments. I'm thrilled that it feels still relevant 4 years later. It should. I mean, this is the idea, is that this generational mindset is something that moves with them through the life stage. So hopefully it stays relevant for a good time longer.
Well, look, I'm a big fan of yours. I always have been.
Likewise.
And so, when I saw that and it's like, this is my friend Scott and he's doing a TED talk and he's, you know, and you could just tell like when that thing first hit that it was a lot of people were going to be listening. And, because you're a pretty good voice for all this. So
I love it. I feel so lucky that I somehow, you know, on the Gen X conference, as we started our talk, I found out that there was this idea of generational thinking and there were some really smart people in there talking about it. And it just, I mean, I was like, oh, I'm way more interested in this than anything else I'm doing right now. And it's provided me with a pretty fun little career.
It's carried you. That's good. Well, I think a lot of us can relate to that, you know, finding something that you just love and taking it and being passionate about it. That's a great example, Scott, I think. So I appreciate your time, man. And I know that my listeners, the listeners of the Turfgrass Zealot Project they're going to love this. And part of it is because, like I told you, this business that we're in is kind of a young person's deal, you know? And I remember when I first, when my first, you know, job in the golf business, my boss was 30 and he was like the oldest guy that I knew besides my parents. You know, I mean, this kind of happens that way, you know, and people get pretty good breaks when they're younger and that sort of thing. And I think studying the changing, shifting world is not a bad thing. And I really appreciate you lending.
Hopefully some of your listeners are actually millennials and they feel like they, like somebody understands them.
You know what? I think that a lot of them are millennials. I think a lot of them are going to believe that we care, and you know, who knows where this will go. But, you know, I've always been one of those guys like you that has a youthful kind of thing. And I like to be around young people and do young stuff. And, you know, I was super stoked because I just got the new Call of Duty game. And I mean,
you and my 13-year-old.
Right, yeah, exactly. Like, I remember you and I had an exchange once about the YouTube videos that your son and I were both watching about, you know, some video game. And I'm hanging on to my youth, dude. And I hope that's relatable. But I appreciate your time, Scott. And Scott Hess on the Turfgrass Zealot Project. Take care, man.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
So there it is. And I want to thank Scott Hess and Chris Tritabaugh both for joining me on this episode of the Turfgrass Zealot Project. You know what? Man, you can't get more than a few minutes of those guys' time. Both amazingly busy people. And I just appreciate them being able to do this for me and do this for us and do this for you. And you know what I want to do? I want to encourage you to think differently. Think differently about millennials. Think differently about your kids, about your young employees. Think differently about yourself. How about that? On the next episode of the Turfgrass Zealot Project, Armin Suni is going to be back. And Armin, besides being my second guest in all of this podcasting thing, is also going to talk to us about the job interview, job selection, job search, job hunting process. And it's going to be enlightening, and we're not going to pull any punches. This is Dave Wilbur. I'm the Turfgrass Zealot. This is the Turfgrass Zealot Project. Thanks for listening on TurfNet Radio. And now, you can return to your life of killing grass. Take care.